Good morning, and welcome to the Filson Historical Society. I'm Mark Wetherington, Director, and I want to thank you for joining us for the 15th year of our Filson Institute public conferences. And for this particular fall institute, a special institute, Viewing the South from a 21st Century Perspective, the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. And it's really a wonderful opportunity for us to get together and acknowledge this milestone in our scholarship and our learning and our understanding of Southern history and culture that this encyclopedia project represents. And I want to thank all the folks that came from Oxford and other points all over the compass to present lectures to us for this institute. Our mission is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and the Ohio Valley region's history and culture. And if you're not a member of the Filson, I invite you to join us. Sarah Strapp, our membership coordinator, is at the back of the room, and she has a membership brochure, and she'll be happy to tell you all about membership opportunities. And we do need your support here at the Filson, so I do invite you to join us. You can find out much more about our program of work and all we do at the Filson. We have many, many, many programs and wonderful research collections here at the Filson by going to our website, www.filsonhistorical.org. And following us, stay engaged by going to our blogs and Facebook and Pinterest and Twitter and Tumblr. We heard Charles Reagan Wilson talk about how technology is helping us, in a way, document and change our history. Last night at his really excellent keynote address. And how many of you were here last night? So you've heard a lot of this before, but I'm going to say it again for those who weren't here. We're making tremendous strides here at the Filson. I said this is our 15th year of the public conferences, and these conferences let us set aside 2 days instead of a single lecture to look at a special issue or project or topic, and that's the idea behind the conferences. In a couple of years, we'll be in a new room. We'll be in a wonderful, exciting building, and the across the alley at 4th and Ormsby. We'll have 260 seats. We'll have a whole lot more exhibit space and storage space. So we're looking forward to that. It's appropriate that this institute, which discusses the six significant changes in the South, has experienced and still faces, is based on the Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. And let me just point out at this time that the Filson's research collections are invaluable to our study and understanding of this history and culture. Many of our scholars who are here today and other researchers have used our collections and have benefited from those collections, which we continue to build. Now, without further ado, well, let me first of all say this. You may have picked up a revised copy of the program today. If you haven't, it gives you some more specific times. So now, it's my pleasure at this time to introduce our first speaker for the Friday day of lectures, Estelle Curtis Pennington, art historian. His topic is Looking South, Form and Meaning in Southern Studies. Mr. Pennington received his undergraduate degree from the University of Kentucky and his master's degree from George Washington University. He has served in curatorial capacities at a number of institutions, including the Archives of American Art, the National Portrait Gallery, the Lauren Rogers Museum of Art, the New Orleans Museum of Art, and the Morris Museum of Art. He is co-editor of the Art and Architecture volume in the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. He is also author of Kentucky, the Master Painters from the Frontier Era to the Great Depression, and Lessons in Likeness, Portrait Painters in Kentucky and the Ohio Valley, which features collect portraits from the Filson's own collections as well as those from other institutions. That volume is available in the lobby, and it's also the basis for portrait tours, which take place here at the Filson. And you can check at the front desk for times of those tours. So without further ado, Estelle, thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
Hello. Towards the end of the lecture, I will give you the definitive answer on whether or not Kentucky is indeed Southern. which will, of course, include some rather unfortunate observations about Louisville, but nevertheless, which is Indiana. Only the river changed. Let's start out with this quote. By the way, speaking of Louisville, I really want to congratulate the Filson on having recently gotten the gift of this marvelous landscape view of Louisville. And I am very much interested in working on the idea that it could very well be a Robert Scott Duncanson, because it uses the same format Duncanson used for his wonderful view of Cincinnati, where there's the tiny little figure on the Kentucky bank looking across the shore at yet another Yankee hellhole. All right, let's get going. By the turn of the century, this is from C. Van Woodward's Origins of the New South, and I want to set it up as sort of our methodological framework, and I want you to be my students, and I really want you to get some of this stuck in your head as we're looking at it. By the turn of the century, it was time for the generation that had grown up in the post-Reconstruction period to take command of the cultural life of the South. As a rule, people of this generation were unprepared for the task. They were the children of the cultural famine that blighted the land of their youth, and they came to manhood bearing the marks of intellectual malnutrition. The bread of learning and leisure and art and travel had been dealt out to them scantily, if at all. From the example set to them by their fathers, they could not but conclude that achievement was something measured pretty strictly in material terms, and that one looked northward for the standard of excellence. Sterility and imitation were the marks of the culture they produced. This is a marvelous construct. To illustrate this, I show you a picture of Charleston after some particularly untidy visitors had swept through. This is Charleston in the aftermath of the bombardment. And it's also a photograph by an extremely important early American photographer named Barnard, George Barnard with an A. And he took photographs all over South Carolina and Georgia of ruins, some of which I used in my book, Lookaway, in a chapter entitled Ruin and Remembrance. In taking apart that Woodward comment, let's think about the inherent structure that it suggests. The idea that the people of the South were malnourished because they were underexposed to broader trends outside their culture, implying a high culture based on a consensus of taste. The idea that there is one culture, one overculture, one high culture, and we look to that for a standard. Now, that's hardly groundbreaking news, because that, to some extent, is the interplay here. And the interplay, in the way that we may want to look at painting in the South, is the interplay between the idea of looking at something that might meet a broad consensus and achieve, quote, approval, as opposed to the phenomenology of looking at a culture and what it has produced and either enjoying it or operating thereby. That is a subtlety which is very important to hang on to. Look, do you look around you, or do you look up and then look around you? And this entire business of looking northward outside their own culture, all kidding aside, this is something that drives me crazy, because it is the Kentucky and larger southern phenomenon of we've got to invite an outside expert to come in and tell us what to do. We've got to have someone come down from New York and tell us how to design our houses. We've got to have somebody come from Indianapolis and show us how to design our racetracks, car racing, or that kind of thing. And I get it. It's the whole rural v. urban mentality. And, you know, Mark kind of alluded to this. I did get up and leave Bourbon County and went off to various places and got educated and lived in European cities and all of that. And then I come home and I live in what I regard as my wonderful world. And people say to me things like, oh, well, you know, he's a specialist in Kentucky painting. Actually, I'm a graduate of a PhD program. I'm a specialist in Europe, in American and British painting from 1760 to 1860. I'm not just Jimmy Crack Corn, Kentucky. And I get people who call me up on the phone, oh, Sotheby's recommended you to appraise this or evaluate this for me, but you live in Kentucky? You know, what would you know about this? And I say, well, of course, in the old days, I could say, I'm not sure, could you hold it a little closer to the phone? But I can't say that anymore because people have walkie-talkies you can see things on. So there goes my line. And then the idea that sterility and imitation sums up their achievements. I know what he means, and I venerate him. He's a wonderful mind. But the idea that what we were creating in the South in the Reconstruction era and beyond was sterility and imitation. I mean, of course, I could show you some photographs of houses in Atlanta, like the one Scarlett built after the war, that are indeed imitations of a grand manner. But that's not the whole picture. Does this work now? In my career, Lord God, in 1977, the Smithsonian, Archives of American Art, allowed me, largely because I had Bingham funding, allowed me to tour the South and make lists of paintings and gather information, and it was the background to the Painting in the South exhibit held in 1985. I was one of the field researchers for that, and I accumulated a lot of material and made a lot of checklists on Southern objects. Hard to believe that this was at the dawn of when we were creating a national database and we were doing it with key punch cards in 1977. And I would enter this on key punch cards, which you cannot correct, and take it to the mall, which is to say the National Mall, the Smithsonian, not the, you know, one at St. Matthew's, and get it printed out on these long sheets. And that's how we began to identify these artists and identify these artworks. And just 30-odd, whatever it is, 6 years ago, we did not really have a collective database on painting in the South or art in the South, the kind of thing that eventually resulted in this. The second step in this process, this is just traditional art history, is to document, to search for primary and secondary sources that help you fill out a knowledge of the object and a knowledge of the artist. And then, of course, the third step is to interpret, which is a very sticky wicket, as our English cousins say, which we'll have a little conversation about. In terms of identification, we owe what we know about art in the South to three sources. We owe it to the Colonial Dame's portrait books, and I appreciate this with all my heart because the Colonial Dames in each state and commonwealth did these portrait books out of certain Shintoistic motivations, but there are, this is extremely important, we have to have a balance of humor and profundity here. There are very intelligent women involved in women's organizations who use their talents and skills to create certain things. And Edna Talbot Whitley's Kentucky Antebellum Portraiture and Mrs. Thomas Nelson's Louisiana Portraiture. And these portrait books had the only biographical information we had on a very disparate group of itinerant portrait artist. And one of the things that I did with the help of some volunteers that I thanked, I made a meal for them and I thanked them and I do thank them profusely at the Lauren Rogers Museum, is that at the dawn of photocopying, we photocopied every Colonial Dames volume for the entire South and cut them up into artist files. The photocopies, cut them up into artist files, so that I began with an extensive file, which I have to this day, of images by the various Southern itinerant portrait artists, and we'll come back to that. The second source that we owe for our information about painters in the South is the WPA Writers Project, and I one of the things I have had the great joy of finding so many things of being on the frontier of this field of study. One of the things I found buried away in the basement of the New Orleans Museum of Art were the WPA artist archives. And they recorded newspaper articles and all of this material into a typescript manuscript, which I was able to use when I did my book, Downriver, Currents of Style in Louisiana Painting. Right down here at the Louisville Free Public Library, there is an entire wall of bound volumes of newspaper clippings organized by artist. That's an outcome of the WPA project. A collection of material that should be microfilmed or whatever you do. What do you do? Digital, I don't know, something. It should be reproduced in some way so it can be pulled up on something or the other, but I wouldn't know. And then the third source of all of this, time to come out of the closet about this kind of thing, are the endeavors of a lot of, quote, confirmed bachelors and gay men. This institution is the recipient of a tremendous amount of information from a confirmed bachelor who had some sort of confusing name. We all have what my friend Van Meter Foster Pettit calls law firm names. We all have names. Estelle Curtis Pennington, you know. Standard Dodd McKee, you know. And he had this name, Rogers Clark Ballard Thruston Morton Norton, or some kind of a name where he took his mother's name because there weren't any more of them. And so then, but anyway. And gay men. And this is not at all meant to be some sort of shocking statement, but I show you the picture of a marvelous book called A Passion to Preserve, which is about the history of gay men in many communities across the country who saved houses, kept lists, listened to their grandmothers, who were interested in this. They were maybe not the kind of boys that were out there smacking a baseball across the field or stuff like that. And so we owe them a great debt. I suppose this would be controversial, but I will name names. Gordon Cotton in Vicksburg, Bill Floyd in Lexington, Bert Harder in New Orleans. Every community had this. And I think we're living in an age where we're getting to be more comfortable with the idea of different groups of people making contributions to our world. Now, in terms of identify, I just want to show you some examples. Largely because this is an encyclopedic effort, and I want to do something that really falls into the category of TMI and just show you a broad array, just to show you how wonderfully rich the artistic and visual arts heritage of the South is. And I've summed up some of the interesting movements. Antebellum portraiture, for reasons known only to God and my grandmother and Her Majesty the Queen, I have been fascinated by portraiture since I was a child. Because as a child, we would go out to Bucknor, and there was this picture of this little girl sitting in a field of flowers, and I was like, who's that? And I was just, and then I got terribly fascinated by the whole business of itinerant portrait artists, scores, hundreds. of portrait painters who moved about the South painting. And I got very absorbed in where were they and how did they move and what did they leave behind? You know, kind of like the breadcrumb trail or the bird droppings or whatever. And here we have Charles Bird King's wonderful portrait, itinerant artist, of his experiences painting in Virginia. And it tells the whole story of the itinerant portrait tradition. There's the erudite portraitist. There's the sitter in her best bonnet. There's the head on the canvas. Notice that it's not a body without a head. It's a head without a body. And, oh dear, ragweed. Excuse me. For me, this led to an entire episode of recording this that ultimately culminated in this, for which I'm deeply grateful to the Filson for being able to produce two lessons in likeness. The portrait artist took advantage of the great Whig innovation of public transportation, public works, canals, roadways. They worked up and down the Mississippi River. One of the fascinating things is that there's a whole tradition of travel from Cincinnati to New Orleans and back, and from New Orleans to here and back, so that our portrait artists, Matthew Harris Jewett, Joseph Henry Bush, William Edward West, went to New Orleans and painted, and their portrait artists, Theodore Sidney Moise, Trevor Thomas Fowler, came upriver and painted here and stopped in the plantations along the way. An example of that cross-cultural fertilization would be Matthew Harris Jewett from Lexington painting Joel Destrehan, the builder of Destrehan House in Hummus, Louisiana, in New Orleans. Another example would be my beloved William Edward West here painting Robert E. Lee in Baltimore as West was going south and Lee was going west in 1840. This picture kick-started my entire career. I was filing photographs of paintings at the Catalog of American Portraiture in the hot summer of 1978 in Washington, D.C., and there was a pile of photographs, and this black and white photograph came up, and for a variety of reasons, I said, "Who is this?" And Ellen Miles, my beloved mentor and professor and dear friend, looked at me like, "You idiot, that's Robert E. Lee by William Edward West. That's one of your own painters, don't you know?" I was like, "William Edward West?" And no bells went off because, you know, in Kentucky, every single painting was done by Matthew Harris Jewett, regardless of when or date or subject, you know. He painted the Mona Lisa and he painted Washington crossing the Delaware and all of that, and I guess I better move on from Bill Ed. At the Portrait Gallery, we gave all of our portrait show painters names. Robert Ed Pine became Bobbage, and William Everett West became Bill Ed, and that was one of our little games. The genre tradition in the South, a lot of which tends to be focused upon Kentucky subjects, William Tolley Rannie, working out of North Carolina at that point with his great image of Boone's First View, historical genre painting. I love this painting. It's one of my favorite paintings, largely because I love Daniel Boone's brother, Squire Boone, saying, "It's over there," and pointing to it. And that is indeed Kentucky. George Caleb Bingham's great Jolly Flat Boatman tradition. I lost several battles to the now departed, God rest her soul, Jesse Pesch. And one of the battles that I lost to Jessie Pesch is that she would not let us include George Caleb Bingham in the Painting in the South exhibition because, oh, you know, he's not a Southerner. You know, he's from Missouri. Despite the fact that, and he didn't own slaves, despite the fact that, and he was an emancipationist. I'm looking to my peers for support here. And the hallmark of being an antebellum Southerner is not that you owned slaves. There is a larger constellation of that, a topic we'll come back to. These are Southerners. These are Kentuckians going south to New Orleans to be involved in the trans-Mississippi trade. Our bourbon, our mules, our hemp, our flatboats going to New Orleans, and their goods coming back upriver to us. That's very much a part of that trade. And then later, the marvelous tradition of historical genre painting in which the issue of race is confronted. Thomas Sutter White Noble, a Kentuckian with the great price of blood, where the father is about to sell his mulatto son into slavery, his half-caste son into slavery, and the symbolism of that. One of the most fascinating episodes in painting in the South is the Louisiana landscape tradition. Joseph Rustling Meeker bringing luminism to the bayou. Richard Clegg, who went to France and was on the de Lesseps expedition and worked with a lot of the Barbizon artists and came back to paint these. When you see these little jewel-like paintings, they drip with the moisture of that area. That Algiers is across the river from New Orleans. It's not across the river from Marseille or Lyon. Another movement, Summer Day by Helen Turner, Impressionism in the South. Now, one of the interesting things about the very period that C. Van Woodward talks of as being a period of sterility and imitation is that in the beginning in the 1880s, you suddenly have an abundance of self-actualizing women artists, women who get themselves together, study art, go where there's art education in New York, go to Europe, and come back and paint. And they are legion. Hattie Hutchcraft Hill, Helen Turner, Catherine Wiley, Clara Weaver Parrish, Alice Ravenel U.G. Smith, another law firm name. So this is an incredible manifestation of the art movement in that period. And I'm jumping ahead in a way, but in the interplay back and forth, where I'm caught between the politically correct camp on the one side and the quaint camp on the other side, just when I thought we were making some progress in Southern art studies, someone sends me an essay that I've come to understand better, that on Helen Turner was such a great painter because she had a woman's sensibility and she liked to sew. Now, at first I was like, oh no, not more of that. I have come to reflect that she had a woman's sensibility. She was able to stop and think, and she could sew, which means that she was able to sit by herself and engage herself in an occupation and contemplate. And a good deal of what Impressionist painting is about is moment. And here we see one of Helen Turner's great paintings in the Greenville, South Carolina collection of this young woman at a moment of perfection. Helen Maria Turner, born Louisville, Kentucky, by the way, and spent much of her life in New Orleans. Our own local Patty Thumb, another self-actualizing late 19th century woman artist, with her great painting, Lilies of the Field, one of the great paintings from our own artistic heritage here in the Commonwealth. And this is Annie Fellows Johnson's daughter. This is the model for the Little Colonel, and this is indeed a scene in Pee Wee Valley. So here, the Impressionist. Then you have what I think I've come to call them the visionary expressionist. You have the wonderful nutcase artists like McKendry Robbins Long with his painting The Great Deceiver, in which the Great Deceiver is casting down things. I love these proto-Cecil B. DeMille paintings where there's stuff going on like this. An artist who I absolutely adore. I have been fascinated by her since my distant cousin Billy Ferris showed me her work in the 70s, and that's Theora Hamblett from Oxford, Mississippi. And several of her works were based on games and the way she paints her trees and the people jumping rope. This comes back to the idea of personal expressiveness. Art is personal expressiveness. Art might be something else. Art is personal expressiveness, and we see that here. The realism and naturalism tradition from the First World War through the Great Depression and on into World War II, totally unsung woman painter from Kentucky who I've become absolutely enamored of, Lucy Deeks. Lucy Deeks' painting of a woman reading in the Speed Art Museum collection here in Louisville, which I think sums up the whole business of the transformation from Impressionism to Naturalism, the ease with which she's sitting, the suggestion of three-dimensionality on a two-dimensional plane, the contrapposto pose that we see here. If I do Volume 2, Kentucky the Master Painters is subtitled From the Frontier Era to the Great Depression, I may be about to embark upon a 1932, I'm not sure what I want my cutoff date to be, because never in my career have I wanted to have to deal with living artists. The dead are so much easier. And I'm just not the person to deal with living artists, so I'm thinking I'll cut it off somewhere where everybody's dead and I don't have to, well, why didn't you use that picture? Or, don't you know I'm better than that painter? Anyway, and then we do have an abstract, non-objective movement in the South. That's a whole semester's course in itself. The idea of our indisposition to abstraction. the idea that we like stories and tales and things we can see and things we can talk about, that we're not so particularly interested in this. And I have to say, this is more my opinion, Lamar Dodd and Bill Halsey and Ida Kohlmeier, you know, Ida Kohlmeier, Mark Rothko wannabe, Bill Halsey, Adolf Gottlieb wannabe, Lamar Dodd, Picasso wannabe, I do think our non-objective movement in the South, with the exception of Sam Gilliam from Louisville, who invented a new expressive form and who invigorates the idea of the interplay between two and three dimensions in his wonderful work, I don't think non-objective painting is our greatest moment. Now, on the issue of documenting, I mean, step one for me was finding these people. Step two was finding material about them. And the first thing I set about doing was finding the papers of William Edward West. And it took me over a year, and I found them 30 miles from Washington. Having looked in Nashville, New Orleans, Natchez, I finally found the trunk of his diaries and letters and his account of painting Lord Byron and his correspondence from his days in England. And that's what informed my first book, William Edward West, Kentucky Painter, which accompanied my exhibition on West at the National Portrait Gallery in 1985. Documenting sources, museum vertical files, I found a great deal of information, even primary information, that was stuck away in vertical files in museum libraries because they thought no one would ever be interested. So I pulled up photocopies of Matthew Harris Jewett out of a vertical file in the Lexington Public Library. The Archives of American Art, where I worked, I gathered a lot of primary material for the archives on painting in the South, on Southern artists, but the Archives of American Art was also the beneficiary of one of the art world's great frauds, Charles Henry Hart, who collected what he called artist autographs. They happened to be attached to letters, and so a lot of material there. Historical societies, of which this is one, obviously the Bounty, universities, and of course, personal property. When I lived in Mississippi, I had the great experience of going to places outside Vicksburg, outside Natchez, where there were houses where families had lived like ours in the same house forever, and there was a portrait and there was letters on the actual sitting. And when I worked doing all that, part of why I went to Mississippi is that one of the first things I published was called The Kentucky-Mississippi Itinerancy, in which I traced the relationship between the Kentucky painters and Mississippi and vice versa. And so I went around to a lot of Mississippi houses and found that information. Now, on the interpret front, interpretation, it's about, I want you to absorb this, what informs the object and how does the object inform us? And when we look at something, when I taught adults, when I lived in Amsterdam, I taught a course called Learning to Look. What do we see when we're looking? What do we see when we look at that portrait of Roger Clark, Ballard, Thurston, Morton, Norton, James? We see a child in an idyllic landscape clad in historic costume with a vague reference to Carl Hogg's paintings of Queen Victoria's children at Balmoral. So we see stylistic interaction. The study of style is the traditional preoccupation of art history. What have we learned? How do we learn? I think the hardest thing when we're teaching is, especially at this point, this is not a photograph. This is not even an illustration. This is an assemblage of paint and canvas. This is the artist's interactive, interpretive hand-eye ability of looking at you and sketching you in that way. So this is not only an image, it's also a process and a technique and a craft. Totally almost forgotten now, which was not when I was coming along, is teaching about glazing, the building up of colors, transparent varnishes, you know, how an object is actually made. And that's the stylistic approach. Then there's the whole economic business, the sort of pseudo-Marxist interpretation, supply and demand, who wanted this and why, and what were the market variables. And then there are the literary parallels. One of the great stylistic examples is the fact that Matthew Harris Jewett went to Boston in 1815. He painted with Gilbert Stuart. He kept a diary of that episode. He wrote about what Stuart taught him, and then he came back, and based on the unfinished head of George Washington, Stuart painted on commission for George and Martha, and then kept and never returned to them, Gilbert Stuart. And then here we have, of course, the Matthew Harris Jewett version. And they were extremely popular, and they were a great source of income. And so there you have the interplay. And as recently as when Ellen was working on her Metropolitan Art Gilbert Stuart show, there was still some question, is this Gilbert Stuart or is this Matthew Harris Jewett? And because of the excellence of his style. Then there's the economic perspective, them what gots is them what gets. And one of the explanations of this great portrait of Asa Blanchard, our great silversmith from Kentucky, is that the cut line for this painting is that this is Asa Blanchard. He was able to afford to have this portrait painting because he hired apprentices who he paid very poorly. That's supposed to sum up, you know, that entire painting. I was trying to find a portrait of Horace Holly, the great founding president of Transylvania University, so I could say, this is a portrait of Horace Holly. He could afford to have this portrait painting because he had students, you know. So I don't know. The market obviously plays a big role, but I don't know. And then there's the literary parallel. And one of the great opening, you could do a small, lovely book with three chapters on A, the assassination of Huey Long, B, Robert Penn Warren's great novel, All the King's Men, and C, John McCready's, this is in my top 10 all-time list, The Assassination of Huey Long, one of the great manifestations of magic realism in the South, where you've got the shoot 'em up bang bang going on, and the four of Dr. Crozat, who shot Huey Long twice. You know, that whole story, that whole interaction. And our precious Robert Penn Warren, fellow Kentuckian, never before and never since did he really reach that height in some ways. Although it is a wonderful book. I shouldn't take too much time, but that opening scene when he talks about how sticky the tar road was and Jack Burden and all that. So there is that. And I have pursued that quite extensively in my own writing. I have frequently tried to open out paintings, especially Impressionist paintings, by finding commentary on the landscape. For example, the Tryon North Carolina painters and the Tryon travel writers, to coordinate that, to describe the scene in their terms. Now, here's the uh-oh. These are my uh-oh categories. And these are the things that cause me angst. And one of them is regionalism. And that makes me just extremely nervous. When someone starts referring to the art of the South as regionalism, I just know it's not going to have a very happy ending, especially if I'm in the conversation. But here we have the so-called Smithsonian American Art Museum. This is the backside of it, which in the age in which we live, my alma mater, the National Portrait Gallery, is now called the Donald W. Reynolds National Portrait Gallery because of the contribution he made. But somehow or the other, we have a regional construct and we have a national construct. And art in the South is regional, and there's some kind of national art. Well, here is something that's very hard to understand. This is the National Museum of American Art, in which there is not a single Southern painting hanging, in which you have a Western section. Of course, you have the usual roundup of Northeast suspects, and that lot. And then a bunch of Jim Crack modernists working out of, you know, New York. Not a single Southern painting. And not only an interest in it, but an absolute aversion to it. And I'll come back to why that might be. And it brings to mind a very important dialogue. If there's a national art, how is it determined? To the victor belongs the spoils? You've got Winslow Homer painting the Union side, so therefore he's a national artist. And you've got unknown people like John Mooney and Conrad West Chapman painting the Southern side, so therefore they're out. Also, and this plays into our whole national identity, is the Northeast Critical Corridor the end-all, be-all of American identity? Is that how we think of ourselves? And finally, the market thing. Who gets the biggest prices in New York is the standard by which all other art is judged. And that comes back to that whole idea of we've got to look to a point of sanctification. You know, it's got to have been sanctified in New York. Story I shouldn't tell. I'm in New York. Of course, I'm buying monogram towels at Lord & Taylor's. I'm at the Lord & Taylor towel counter, you know, ordering three sets of monogram towels in baby blue with white letters. And the person at the towel counter says to me in New York, "What's the mailing address?" And so I say, "Oh, The Ridge, 1581 Cane Ridge Road, Paris, Kentucky." "Paris, Kentucky? And you're in New York?" And he said, "Aren't you afraid?" Well, I'm not proud of what I said. Because I said, "Are you embarrassed to be selling towels at Lord & Taylor's?" So, I don't know. I don't get it. I don't get that place. I mean, I don't know. Seemingly, if we had a national art, it should be in Washington. Name a Washington painter. So I don't know. I can't go to this regional thing. The absence of Southern art in the National Museum. Recently, the major exhibition, widely reviewed and heralded by the New York Times, American Art in the Civil War, not one Southern painting. This is after the curator toured the South and received hospitality in various Southern cities and then said, decided it was too risky to use Southern painting because it might bring up controversy. Okay, well, let's just closet them. Let's just put all Southern painting and all game in the same room and close the door. And then the absence of Southern art in a recent critical volume, which actually called itself House Divided, which is actually a novel by Ben Ames Williams, American Art Since 1955, not one single mention of a Southern painter. And so what have I been doing? Can I just retire now and become a decorator? I mean, it's time for that. The other thing that just drives me out of my mind, some of you have heard this, folk art. There is no such thing as folk art. There are folk objects, walking sticks, ceramic bowls, quilts, weather vanes. There are communal products that come out of a folk in Deutschland, out of a folk tradition. This is not about painting. It does not serve painting well. For one thing, think about this, learning to look. Don't put lenses between yourself and the object. Oh, I'm looking at a folk art. No, you're looking at a visual representation. Start there. This folk thing is a product of New York and New England imaginations from the 1920s when a bunch of gimcrack dealers got together and found a bunch of cheap stuff for sale in New Hampshire and put it on the market as folk art representing the American character. And, you know, I got it for a dollar. You may have it for $15,000. And then this American Folk Art Museum, non-compliant visual expression existing outside prevailing currents of style. How about that? That is how we might regard what some people call folk art. Clementine Hunter, the great painter in Louisiana, is a painter who is offering a response to the historical settings in which she lived. What informs this object and what informs us is her viewing a hunt with birds in the air. Don't denigrate it by calling it folk. Drink in the richness. This is an extremely rich visual object full of motion and pattern and remembrance. Our own Edgar Tolson. Don't call this folk sculpture. What's its tradition? It's a personal expression of psychosexual inhibition and longing. I kind of wanted to show you some of the more risque ones where, you know, Adam and Eve are kind of having at it, but I didn't. But here, you just got to love this. One of his recurring motifs is the tree on which Eve is getting the apple. And there she is, and then there are all the critters. The first time I saw those, I was a freshman at the University of Kentucky, and there was an exhibition of them in the Student Center. I was just amazed. Folk art. The first person who ever dealt with Edgar Tolson was a woman whose name I guess I shouldn't mention in Lexington, Kentucky, who bought his art for $50 and sold it at America Hurrah in New York on Madison Avenue for $1,500, thereby reaping the rewards. Folk art is something that's characterized by buy low, sell high, in other words, in which the artist does not profit. But we've had progress. One of the most exciting things to my mind that's happened in recent times is that the art of the wonderful artist whose work I deeply appreciate, Thornton Dial, who was previously known as Outsider Art or blah, 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 his most recent show was just Thornton Dial Artist. He is doing something not unlike Robert Rauschenberg in that he's putting together disparate images, disparate pieces of material culture that he's then using in these constructs. This is a huge step forward. And we are now, in my profession, we are slowly beginning to turn the tide on that whole folk art business and to kind of move beyond it. Uh-oh. This is really hard, and this has driven me crazy, and unfortunately people in this room have had to endure that, but the whole politically correct thing, which has just driven me out of my mind, and I'm really not going to go on about it at great length, but it is the idea that art is a visual document that gives us evidence of various things that are bad. I am not in denial that very bad things have happened, that racism and oppression and slavery are part of our history. Every year I give a lecture on the history of agriculture in Central Kentucky to the Central Kentucky Leadership Conference. Every year there are African Americans in that room. Every year I have to look at that audience and say, there is no doubt that this prosperity was based upon slave labor. So I'm not in denial. What I'm in denial about is that aspects of art somehow raise that banner, that this book, A Golden Haze of Memory, is all about how these poor little old lady artists like Alice Ravenel Eugene Smith and Elizabeth O'Neill Verner and Anna Hayward Taylor working in Charleston, all of this art that they created was had a thinly veiled agenda of racism, and that this image by Alice Smith glamorizes agrarian labor, and that it's actually an illustration of oppression, and these people will never go forward. Again, let me affirm, there couldn't be a worse place than South Carolina, unless it's Texas, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of, well, excuse me, or Kentucky. On matters of racism, although, of course, our great cross to bear in Kentucky is classism more than racism. But does this really glamorize harsh agrarian labor? And do you really have another way to find out about that? And here's what I say when I get up in these people's faces. I use an 18th century English term. Whence cometh the platform? Who called you to the pulpit? The transformational grammar aspect of political correctness is voice. I'm telling you these people were horrible racist bigots, and I'm going to embed that in a scholarly study in which I do this. And I have to say, and this is not all entirely on, if you want to point out great social ills, what's your next act? Or as I like to say, what are your charities? Where is your conscience? If your goal is to point out how perfectly dreadful things have been,
Then, in your spare time, do you volunteer at soup kitchens and with your ministerial association and with your food bank? And do you go to the polls and vote? And do you try to get people registered? What's your second act? And I also have to follow this up by saying, hey, Yankee boy, how about all those pictures you painted of Shoeshine Boys? You think he had a nice life? Is the story of this painting, is the politically correct interpretation of this painting, is that it glamorizes child labor on the streets of New York? All right, moving on. What lies ahead? Potential topics. The southern origins of modern American masters. Magic realism in the South. The background to the rise of southern art museums and collection. The so-called two great masters of American art in the last 50 years, Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, both came from very complex southern backgrounds. Rauschenberg out of Port Arthur, Texas. Jasper Johns out of a broken home in Augusta, Georgia. Both took flight to New York. Both were gay men seeking a place to be expressive. Both created an art in which they embed and hide and closet meaning and mask it with various things. There's a lot of material to mine there. Magic realism in the South. Back to this idea that what we like is stories. Don Cooper's Spirit of Stone Mountain, where we have the Indians. My beloved Douglas Bourgeois from New Orleans. I've written on Douglas, on the magic realism of Douglas Bourgeois. Here, Elvis having a particularly blue Christmas there, being an example of that. That's what's ahead. And then, from my own life and experience, I'm here to tell you, I'm going to write those memoirs someday when I'm, you know, safe from all bullet ranges. I have been involved with the creation of the three great Southern art collections, the Ogden Collection in New Orleans, where eventually Roger Ogden managed to persuade the University of New Orleans to take on his art collection and give him a museum named for himself at public expense, in contravention of Louisiana law about some things, and a museum in which he has yet to sign the deed of gift for the vast majority of the collection there. The Morris Museum of Art in Augusta, Georgia, of Southern painting, where you have Southeastern Newspaper Corporation, which is a Morris concern, the Morris Museum of Art, which is a nonprofit, and Shivers Holding Company. Shivers Holding Company owns the building which the Morris Museum of Art is located. The newspaper makes a $500,000 contribution to the museum, takes a tax deduction. The museum then pays that back to the holding company as rent. So that the Morris Museum of Art in the last 20 years made $20 million on the backs of a tax loophole. So there's that. And then the Johnson Collection, who took me on to write for them, and I kind of kindly suggested perhaps you could call yourself a private collection for public good, and I thought it was headed for a nonprofit. It's not. Now, I have to conclude with my usual observation that not only do we have a rich and fascinating tradition in Kentucky, Bourbon County, that is, and here is my beloved Bourbon County, which you'll see tomorrow, but that, yes, Kentuckians are Southern. And to me, being Southern is about a sense of interconnectedness. It's about a love of place. It's about an awareness of the complexity of life. And I want to conclude because never will I be as grateful as I am for the fact that, hopefully I can find it, that the Center for the Study of Southern Culture and the wonderful project of the encyclopedia allowed me to publish these words. And if I never publish anything else, or if I had never written anything else, I want to read you this last paragraph, or this first paragraph, and I do beg your indulgence. This is my opening remarks. Combining art and architecture in a single encyclopedic reference book is problematic. Artworks are deeply personal expressions of the artist's imagination created by an individuated craft. Architecture is a collective expression of design, spatial occupation, material resource appropriation, and the deployment of a labor force. Though space, material, and labor are all factors of the socioeconomic construct, they are not the usual candidates for aesthetic evaluation. However, as part of the socioeconomic history of architecture, the critical issues they provoked have been addressed in several essays here. At the same time, it is also important to note that the history of architecture is also the history of style, and the history of style is also the history of taste. And taste is an ephemeral human consciousness compounded from longing and desire, ambition and intent, the past and the present, the secular and the spiritual. As architectural designs take on form and leave behind structures upon landscape, they command a visual intention and stir that most basic question of art historical concern. What informs the object, and how does the object inform us?